a Simcar 3.
So, Horace, road trips, you know, this great idea of hitting the open road. You mentioned you've done some recently. I have too. So tell us about the voyage and the trip.
Well, you know, being summer, you know, it's been more of the traditional, I would say maybe even now a more of an older generation thing to do of the road trip. When, you know, John Lasseter, when he talked about in one of the movies or one of the behind the scenes documentaries of the making of the movie Cars, he mentioned how when he was a kid, he, you know, his family would often spend this, you know, a few weeks in the summer driving around the country. And you know, that was such a common thing to do. And I think it's not done as much anymore. People like to fly point to point and not take time to see in between. And that's a bit of a shame, really. I think road trips are one of the nicest ways of spending free time because you get to see some of the parts of the world that aren't necessarily attractive even. I would say they're not designed to be seen, which is what tourist destinations are. But then there are weird things you learn. So one thing I did, I mean, I've taken U.S. road trips. I've taken several. I've driven with family and with friends across the U.S. multiple times in multiple routes. I've always enjoyed it. Unlike some people who really get it, I know a lot of people just hate the idea of being in a car for a couple of hours. You know, I've kind of had to explain this. Had this explained to me why it's uncomfortable to sit in a car for 4 hours. I've sat in the car and driving it all the time for 12 hours without any hesitation. You know, I actually enjoy it. I sort of find it very calming. Other people find it very, very
uncomfortable. Well, it's funny to compare it to alternatives. I mean, you have obviously bus, but certainly air travel today is hardly, for 95% of the population, hardly a pleasant experience.
Well, it's hardly pleasant, but it's the thing is that it's also being a passenger or even a driver, for many people, it's also unpleasant. And I don't understand that. I'm very comfortable. Much more comfortable in the car than I am on an airplane.
Yes,
for a long time. But anyway, that's not my one. I don't want to kind of promote the idea of long distance driving. But I think that what I want to talk about is the experience you get while traversing continents, and the things you learn. So, for example, actually this summer, I should say, I took two road trips. One was in the U.S. It was Boston to Chicago, which I drove with my parents and my son. We went via actually a slightly detour. The straight line would be through Cleveland
Indiana, Illinois.
Yeah. But this time we took a little detour. We went south a bit and hit Dayton, Ohio.
And Wright-Patterson. Yeah.
Yeah, to the Air Force Museum, which, by the way, if you're into airplanes, I think, you know, I've seen a lot of museums, a lot of air and space museums, and this one is probably up there among the best, if not the best. It doesn't have the same character as some of the smaller places, but the National Museum of the United States Air Force is a plane mecca. It's just amazing, and it's really off the beaten path. It is not a very frequently traveled to destination. It's like I said, in the middle of nowhere, relatively speaking, Dayton, Ohio. But I mean, it's not in Dayton. It's actually somewhat. It's Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is a big area outside of Dayton. So anyway, that was one trip. Then comparing that trip to the one I took in Europe, which was actually getting from Helsinki to Brussels in Belgium and back. Now, that
trip, it's a good distance.
Well, the funny thing is that it's broken up into two, into a water section, because Helsinki to, you can't get there without, if you go via land routes only, it would be huge detours. You'd either have to go north to right. cross into Sweden up in the north, and which is in the wrong direction, or you'd have to go east into Russia, which is again in the wrong direction and not a very comfortable place to transition through. And there are other ways of sort of crossing the Baltic Sea, but the one we took was to Germany, to
Rostock,
which is actually former East Germany.
Right.
So
right.
firstly, okay, you get to go by ship.
So it's an intermodal journey, yes.
Yeah. And the ship, by the way, isn't a cruise ship. It is actually a ferry designed for
right.
trucks, which
right.
takes cars as a hobby.
Because, yes, I've been on some of those, indeed.
Yeah, the cars are...
Baltic, yeah.
The cars are actually in a little tunnel that wraps around the main cargo area, which is where the trailers for truck trailers are stored, and the cars are essentially in this one ship we basically they're like in a one behind the other in the little tube, and this ship had only 30 cabins or so. No, sorry. I think even had less than that. I think
wow.
it could only handle, you know, like 100 people. But it was great because it was somewhat
beautiful voyage, really.
Yeah, it's like a day and a half.
Right.
You get to experience the sea and sea voyage, and this ship was a bit old and it kind of had a time capsule feel, and it was a bit empty, so it felt also that you really were in isolation. But anyway, I don't want to talk about ships, but here's my take on what I saw. Firstly, Germany, where we came into, is absolutely covered with windmills now. This is something that I hadn't noticed before. Maybe this time because we were in the northern part of Germany.
Well, the old East, too, they had a huge tax subsidy for
yeah.
wind and solar. Solar, I found ironic, given the cloud cover there.
Yeah, solar isn't the best place, but
right.
they do have a huge subsidy, and you do see some solar. But from the highway, I was struck by how many. They became somewhat something you almost tune out because. But these are enormous windmills. Or wind turbines. I don't know technically the correct term, but they were basically, I don't know, hard to gauge the size because there's nothing to compare them to on an open field, but I'd say they were like 100 feet tall. And there were literally hundreds of them. They're just everywhere. And then you cross into the Netherlands and there's none. And you can sort of almost tell you're in a different country because you stop seeing windmills. And so that kind of puts into perspective also the energy question, because Germany has, through subsidy, created demand for you know, if you own land,
energy, right?
Yeah, if you own land in Germany, apparently the incentives are there for you to put up windmills and solar panels, unless to, you know, farm it or whatever, but. It is an interesting sight to see. These are they looked expensive, to be honest. I mean, when these turbines and the pillars that hold them and the blades and everything and the size and the magnitude we're looking at is must be quite a large cost there. But that's their, you know, that's what they decided to do. The other thing was this difference in. Okay, the German road system is many places has no speed limit.
Right, it's superb.
And so you get into the whole difference in feel of driving. And okay, then you cross borders, and then suddenly it's a completely different feeling. Now, we drove in a diesel, and this was the Mini Clubman is our car, and so it's a Mini. That is a little bit larger than Mini, not as big as the the very biggest one, which is called the Countryman. This is the Clubman, which is just looks like a tiny little station wagon. But the thing is that it has a 1.6-liter diesel, and I didn't really try to max it. I did maybe on the Autobahn make it up to, oh, I forget now, but it was like 220 kilometers an hour or so.
Good.
but that was very briefly. And just to see, you know, what she could do. Right. But but my wife
sort of like Montana or Nebraska or Kansas. Right?
Yeah, you know, it was my constraint there. Was actually my wife and not the car.
Right.
But the it was very good car at that speed. I mean, it even with a diesel, which by the way had like I think it has 105 horsepower, not a lot of power in it,
but a lot of torque though generally.
Generally in low speeds, but you know when you're dealing at a high RPMs, it doesn't make that much difference. But the thing was that I noticed also is because the car tells you fuel economy, and so we did this journey which actually came out to 1,600 kilometers, which is just exactly 1,000 miles. And in fact, that distance we drove in Europe is about the same as driving to Chicago, interestingly enough.
Right.
So what I measured is because I set the trip thing.
Sure.
Yeah. So I saw our overall mileage over that whole distance. So some of the driving was stop and go. In fact, some of the worst traffic jams I've ever experienced were in Germany during this period of time, which is holiday peak time. But there was one time that the traffic was so bad, you know, you actually stopped, turned off the engine, and people got out and just like sunbathed.
Like Los Angeles. Yeah. Well, Germans like their cars, right?
But I don't think I've ever done that, where you just get out of the car, you know, everybody's lounging around, having discussions. And, of course, because we don't speak German, we couldn't tune in to the radio and find out what's going on. And we were, like, trying to use the Internet to find out. But and then it freed up, and then we drove by, and we just couldn't tell afterwards what caused the problem. I'm not going to bicker too much about Germany, but there's a lot of other complaints I have about the place. You need money to go to the bathroom. You are in constant fear because of the way, you know, the speed differential between, you know, 80 kilometers an hour and 180 or even higher, someone passing you know, you at with a difference of 100 kilometers an hour, which is over, you know, 60 miles an hour. It's crazy. But anyway, what I was going on about is the fuel economy. So, the car we drove, this Mini, ended up getting 4. You know, I should have written it down, but it was like I think I calculated in miles per gallon to be about 53 miles per gallon over the whole trip. Yeah, given stop and go, given some city driving, because we did drive through several cities and stayed in several cities, you know, that's pretty good. I thought that was a good mileage for a car, a modern car. And I don't think you get that, or maybe you get around that for a Prius, but it's rare to get that with a gasoline engine. So
yeah, the best I've ever obtained in my GTI is about 32 on the highway, and that's, you know, 75-85 miles an hour.
Yeah, so this was a lot better on the highway. I think we would have gotten, you know, well over maybe even up to 60 if I had, you know, been really careful. But it came out to be pretty good, which makes it difficult to justify. And also, diesel, by the way, in Europe typically is cheaper than gasoline,
right?
And that's not true in either Britain or U.S. Probably not in Japan either. So in continental Europe, the diesel equation is very, very positive.
It's the car of choice, definitely.
Yeah, and most people actually, I think, especially in southern Europe, buy diesels today. It's the most popular, and every car manufacturer makes a diesel variant. In fact, I remember it used to be quite rare, and very few companies specialized in diesels. Like, you know, in the 70s, for example, Mercedes certainly did. and uniquely had diesel, even large diesel cars. But nowadays, every single car manufacturer that sells in Europe sells a diesel variant. Even American cars are marketed with diesel engines in Europe. So, you know, your Dodge or your whatever, Dodge Caliber or Jeep or other cars that you might see in the U.S. are actually sold in Europe with the diesel option, because otherwise it wouldn't sell at all. So the diesel thing is one thing that I think surprises a lot of people who are not used to Europe.
Although it's growing at a reasonable rate in the States. My parents have a BMW diesel, and a number of friends have Volkswagen diesels. And
sure, the Jetta has been...
I think a third of Volkswagen sales now are diesel, roughly.
That's comforting, and I think I talked about this before. The reasons for the U.S. being behind on this are multiple, but mainly for a long time it was because it was regulated, and in a way that the types they just weren't making the right kind of diesel available, and you needed low sulfur diesel, and the refineries weren't not making it, and because without that fuel you would get much worse emissions, and so the problem is that it was a kind of a chicken and egg problem. The regulators would say no because they're polluting, but the Europeans said, but you could do it if you had the right fuel, and the refineries weren't making the right fuel, and the costs were higher because of distribution issues, and so on. For a while, I don't know what the situation is now, that there were some states that wouldn't permit the sale of new diesel cars at all.
California, right. I think that's
and
changed a
Massachusetts
little bit.
Was the case as well. So if you could switch to low sulfur, and then you would have these particulate filters that emit the soot and the particulate matter from the emissions, which, by the way, is standard in Europe now. So, you know, we drive a diesel, as I said, you could not see anything coming out of the tailpipe. It doesn't look like a diesel in any way.
Part of the problem in the States was the 1970s, when General Motors converted some gas engines to diesel and had disastrous reliability. Again, my father had one, although his was reasonable. So there was a memory effect of
well, sure.
That.
But the Mercedes also had diesels at the same time,
right.
And they were fine. Although, again, some of these trap filters did clog up, and then that gave a bad reputation. But anyway, that is one thing to note, is that even nowadays, they're... diesel is used in race cars. Le Mans, famously, I think Le Mans has been won by a diesel car
Audi
a while now.
Right.
And that's simply because you save so much time in refueling.
Right, right.
Because, and by the way, the thing with the weird thing about diesel is not just the energy efficiency, but because you have higher compression, but actually there's more energy in diesel fuel. There you're not getting something for nothing. The energy content.
Going in, right.
Yeah, so it should be priced higher, because if you price it by joules, but it's not. It's easier to make diesel fuel than it is to make gasoline.
Correct.
It takes for those who are not familiar, making gasoline from crude oil is basically a process of boiling or heating the fuel so that it evaporates, and so you have the distillation process is a process of constantly heating and reheating the results until you get a more pure fuel. Well, the I think this is called cracking, and so you go through like four or five stages to get to gasoline, and diesel like only needs two or three stages. And the very the worst stuff that is the crudest process is to make like tar or make road
road materials.
But then you get to the highest stuff, which is high grade octane, highest octane stuff. But diesel it takes less energy
to
convert,
right,
a crude oil into diesel, right? So it should be cheaper by that measure. Anyway,
regulation that's played a role. As you know, you mentioned Massachusetts and California. There's tax systems. There's all sorts of issues. But I think the larger question you're getting at is what does this mean for the electric guys, right?
Yeah. So just one more thing about this, sure, this economics is that you see how different countries will regulate it. In Germany, a diesel, because there is, quote, more pollution coming out of diesel, they try to discourage it by increasing the price, not of the fuel, but of the car itself.
So right, there's a tax
on the car, which is like 5,000 euros that you pay up front to buy a diesel car. In Finland, it's different because you'd pay your yearly tax. Like in the U.S., you have an excise tax.
Right, evaluated tax.
Yeah, there's a tax on each vehicle, and it's usually a CO2-based tax. And that, in the U.K., they call it a road tax, which actually is not for the roads. It's also an emissions tax. But the emissions tax on diesel is actually higher, so when you got to throw that into the economic equation as well. So it's not just fuel cost,
it's
not just the
cost,
efficiency,
right.
It's the acquisition cost and any ongoing tax
fees,
you might have to pay. But it all works out at the end that and some people say, well, if you drive long enough distances, diesel is more economical. Well, for me, I just like the efficiency of diesel, even if I may pay a little bit more in tax. I just don't like the idea of paying. I mean, I used to have in Finland also an E-Class Mercedes wagon, which was a 3.2 liter six-cylinder.
Probably the best Mercedes built, I think.
It probably was, 1995.
Exactly. Yeah. Last of the good ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And but the only problem with it was that the fuel consumption, when I would fill up, nowadays it cost me half as much. And probably I drive further than I used to in that car. So it's a great car, but it's not one you could use as much as I do the current one. Anyway, so what does this mean? Well, the competition and I think the question for electric cars is that you see how difficult the economic equation might be for a buyer. Deciding in an economy like Europe, where you have quite a good diversity, and you have quite a stress on efficiency because fuel costs are so high, right? You have the equivalent of $8, $9, $10 a gallon, right? Pricing, and the differential used to be much higher, by the way, but now the sort of the U.S. got a bit.
It's going up, right?
So yeah, but the difference is still at least 2 to 1, and so people are very conscious. And they have higher taxes in general on everything, and they have more expensive pricing of cars. And so you have to think very carefully about your transportation option. And in that market, diesel is winning, and it's winning because it has good economics. Now, the one thing that I got as feedback to our last talk show was that, you know, I talked about why aren't cost sensitive,
right? The fleet business,
the fleet market. Well, the best response I got to that was that they're just conservative and slow. So you might expect them to go into the electric market, but it'll take them 20 years or
something. So they're PC buyers.
I don't know. They're just late adopters. Now,
right.
What I would say is, well, you know, if somebody's going to propose to their boss, look, we can save 20% on fuel. I think that would be very attractive somehow. And it's not even an option now to do that because no one's making the car for that market. I heard also, actually read, that in China it's not the case. In China, there is a market for fleet electric vehicles, buses and delivery vans,
sure,
and so on.
Local delivery vehicles. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting in China is that in some here's another data point. I'm not going to maybe make the big connection here, but the other data point that was sent to me was about the electric scooter market. Now, scooters. This data is a bit old. It was from 2006, but the market, the low end transportation market, is definitely scooters, right? And especially in emerging markets. I mean, scooters built half of Asia, because that was the only fiends, and it still is.
They still
probably,
are. All over.
Still are. You know, you go to
take
Indonesia,
your life at risk when you cross the street. Yeah,
yeah. There's a great film that Top Gear did in the Vietnam special, where they had to traverse Vietnam in some form of transportation that would cost a certain amount of money, and it turned out that the only thing they could buy with that money was a scooter. But the point is that that in China, some municipalities, right, some large cities banned these gas-powered scooters because they were polluting too much. They were two-stroke engines, and two-stroke engines, millions and millions.
In the States, yeah, there's not many left.
Yeah, so in Europe, they're banning them from boat use. Right, so if you buy an outboard motor, it has to be four-stroke now because of the pollution and the fact that you spit out oil directly into the lakes.
Right.
So what the Chinese did is they just banned these two-stroke engines in what is essentially millions of people's vehicles, and so the take-up of electric was very, very rapid. So you had these. I think, and again, because it happened early enough in China, is that it gave a leg up to manufacturers who wanted to get into the car making business, the electric car making business, because they learned via going the bottom first, right, the low end battery powered vehicle. And so I'm not sure it's how it's going to play out. I think China may also have kind of gone crazy with cars in general, because
the Germans are very successful there, that's for sure.
Well, everyone, I think that China certainly, one day we need to do a data show, because there's a lot of data on car production, and China is number one right now in cars, not if you include trucks, which the US makes lots of, meaning pickups. But if you include just passenger vehicles, China is number one in production right now, and the number one in consumption. They actually have pretty much even in and out as I should say, production and consumption and demand. The demand is extraordinarily high, but the production is extraordinarily high, so they don't have to depend on imports. And I think that was by design. But anyway. So that's just another data point out there. The bottom of the market in China started with scooters, whereas in Europe, people are focused on efficiency, and diesel is the winner. So then that still leads to the question of how do we see the electric market developing. Now, the other thing that I came across my vision the other day was that the if you look outside of Tesla, the other cars that are the electric optioned are not doing well at all. And these are typically cheaper cars. So you have a phenomenon with Tesla where it's doing extraordinarily well at $80,000, but a car priced below like 30 or even...
Right, Mitsubishi's around 20, and then they go up into the 30s, essentially.
How much is the Leaf?
Leaf is in the mid-20s. Actually, I see a fair number of them around Madison. I think it's a fashion statement more than anything.
But it's 11... They've only sold 11,000 of them.
Nothing.
That's the trouble with the Leaf, and that's in the whole world. So production of Leaf or sales of Leaf are lower, as far as I know, than of Tesla. And also, obviously, we've had the failure of Fisker. We've got the Volt, the Chevy Volt. I don't know how well that's doing. It's also available in Europe on the Ampere brand.
Yeah, they just cut the price.
They cut the price on it, although that's not on the pure electric. It is actually
electric first,
mostly.
Some hybrid, yeah.
Yeah, I've been in one. I've been driven in one. I've looked around it. It actually is a decent car. Given the pricing, I would actually be to me, if I was in the market for an electric car, I would consider the Volt. But it seems that the job to be done. So the question is: so people would ask this question: why is it that we have an emerging market where the most successful entrant is actually at the high end, not at the low end? And that has to do with, again, my hypothesis on the job to be done. Some others would argue that actually the low-end product is no good. Well, I think the Volt is rather good. The Leaf maybe not so good, but it's, you know, for if it's positioned on a job that says it's this is a decent commuter car, that is good for the environment, and that it may cost you a little bit less in fuel. If you position it that way, it fails. But if you position an electric car as being better than an average car, that it is actually appealing to a premium buyer and premium segment as a luxury product, not as an economical product, that being electric is actually better, that seems to be succeeding. And so, but better on what dimension? It's not, it has great performance, but it's better also on this idea of making you feel good about your purchase. And that's where I think, you know, Musk is smart, and I think this is very clever, maybe accidentally so, I don't know. But it starting at the top is an interesting strategy. If you were a regular car maker, it's hard. I'm having a hard time explaining this in the sort of disruptive terms as we've already gone over. But if you also look at Mercedes, even Rolls-Royce or Range Rover, they're starting to make hybrid, they're starting to make electric vehicles, and they're likely to be more successful than the Leafs and the Volts of the world. That's because I think right now electric means something other than economy. Electric means feel good about your purchase decision and you're doing the right thing for them.
It's a statement. It's a branding choice, maybe.
I don't necessarily want to say people want to project an image to others, but they want to actually feel good about themselves. I think that's one of the jobs to be done. It's like I'm doing something good for the environment. For many years, in fact, Hollywood celebrities were proud of the fact they drove Prius or Priuses. So that was the chic thing to do, the environmentally conscious thing to do. So if someone is given the option between a Prius at $25,000 and you know it's an economy car that makes you feel good about your the environment, and then an $80,000 luxury car, you're going to go with the $80,000 car. So that's the interesting thing. Whereas electric powered cars are, you would think, right, the economics of it and the logic of it is that it actually helps you save money or save the environment. It turns out that it's actually successful in the market because it solves a different job, and it's more about feeling good about your purchase and feeling good about the fact that you're over-consuming.
So it fits into the Whole Foods fresh market segment of the world, then, you're saying, the luxury segment.
Yeah, it's more, and some would say maybe, you know, let's say play devil's advocate, that Apple's products as well are premium products, but they tend to also really make good sense for
good
practical
value.
Sure. Yeah, there's definitely good value if you use them intensely. If you're just going to show them off, then it does that job well. But if you're just going to say, you know, I really this is my go-to device for a bunch of things. So Apple doesn't just make aspiration happen. But it is a question in my mind still how the electric market is developing. And if you were making bets a few years ago and you said, look at the success of the Prius, why not make a Prius which is pure electric?
Prius, yeah.
Yeah, that is something actually that isn't as successful as if you made an electric Jaguar or an electric, you know, what turned out to be Tesla. So Tesla made the bet that was sort of almost asymmetric to the logic of this new powertrain. The powertrain that would be cheaper, more efficient, maybe get excited in emerging markets which have potentially lots of sunshine to charge the vehicle with. All these other places where you might think the market would take root. No, it took root at the very top And it's not, so the question in my mind, so here's another layer to this, is what's going to be the response? Having seen the pattern now, would manufacturers try to say, okay, we get it. We get now the positioning. The technical aspect is one thing. Making a good electric car is one thing. And I think they'll get that, and they're getting it. It isn't anything. I don't think there's anything in Tesla's technology that isn't duplicatable. What has been difficult is no one's made the bet the way they made the bet. So the next question is, will we see the traditional manufacturers duplicate the Tesla model, making premium vehicles, pure electric? And so I'm already short-circuiting my own argument here a bit by saying, the counterpoint will be, well, but there are a lot of other magic tricks here. There are these questions about the supercharger network. There are these questions about the
sales network, of course, buying one or leasing one. And
yes,
support,
yes. So it is more
performance. All these.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah. It's a more integrated thing that Tesla is doing, right?
Sure.
It's a system. It's a system, not just the product. Mm-hmm. And so, in that sense, would they have to copy the whole system? So, but my premise is still that Tesla needs to run very quickly to stay ahead of the game, and that there is definitely a response mechanism that's going to be triggered.
Oh, it's already happening. BMW, as you know, has the i8 coming out, 100,000 euros, I believe.
Yeah.
Mostly electric, but again, some hybrid power options, and then the i3 at 43,000. And those cars are interesting to me because of the fact they went composite, so they've gone to a different structure, and we've talked about that a little bit in the past, and
again. I think that's this is where their strength is going to be in.
Yes,
how to re-engineer the production system, how to re-engineer much more deeply in the chassis rather than just the powertrain.
Right. Then
to make
Tesla kept it very similar to the current models, of course.
Because that would have taken billions more.
Right.
I'm sure they could, you know. I'm sure that they're ambitious. But the problem is that it would have taken much more time, and they wouldn't have had the deep bench of talent and of resources to bring to bear.
To make it go,
but
right.
they might, but it becomes a horse race, right? It becomes, when you go head-to-head against an incumbent in a sustaining battle, the innovator's dilemma teaches us that sustaining fights are usually won by the incumbent, and that is because they simply have more resources. It's an attrition battle. It is not an asymmetric battle. It is one of out-grinding the opponent. And historically, and there's a lot of data that says the little guy always loses.
And first to market, first to fail.
it's not a David versus Goliath. It's
right.
Goliath 1 versus Goliath 2. If it is a David versus Goliath and Goliath doesn't have the slingshot, he's only got a little sword, he's going to lose, right? So that's the whole notion of asymmetry is about doing something that the other guy can't do. And that's where I struggle with the long term of Tesla in that respect, the response mechanism is in place for others to copy them. Now the thing again, the premise, and I'm going to play a devil's advocate again here. The premise of Tesla is that not only are we smarter, but we're also faster. And so the logic could be that look, these guys take forever. We already have been at it for 5 years, and now they're finally seeing the light. So by the time they catch up, we're going to move on.
Late,
to the
right.
Next thing.
It's the OODA loop, right?
The problem with that is that it is not clear that Tesla can iterate at that much faster because they're depending on the same process in general to produce. They might be a little faster in development, But at some point, you know, you're dealing with the whole, not just one player. It's not the Tesla versus GM. It's Tesla against the BMW.
Right.
Tesla against Daimler and against every major, you know, Korean, Japanese. Tesla against Toyota. Nobody would accuse Toyota of being stupid and slow. There, you know, why wouldn't Toyota do the same thing at some point? And they have not only deeper pockets, but they have, again, all this talent and experience and manufacturing capacity.
Yeah.
So I wish them very much the best. But the thing I'm struggling with is that this looks to me like Elon Musk saying, you know, I'm just smarter than everybody else. And that is only true until the other guy figures it out.
Right. The Empire Strikes Back, right?
Yeah.
So that kind of leads us into another aspect I wanted to talk about today, and that was the battle for the customer. You know, the certainly Tesla's approach with trying to control the retail experience, the charging station, supercharging stations, and service is quite different than the incumbents with their franchise dealer network and all of that. So we see this business of folks introducing apps and including from ecosystems. You know, Google has one with Volkswagen and others. I mean, are these things, you know, did you use apps when you were traveling and on trips? And what do you think about that?
Couple of things. So we used a couple of apps. Well, obviously navigation.
Sure.
We're not doing anything with the in-car stuff.
You don't have the big screen in your Mini, right?
No. Well, the version we had didn't have that as an option anyway. But the thing that, you know, we had, actually we have obviously iPhones, but I think my wife also has a Nokia 900. So this is Lumia.
Sure.
Well, the good thing about that is actually that it lets you download maps and keep them cached or keep them local.
So you don't use bandwidth. Yeah.
Exactly. So that turned out to be very useful. Although it was a bit bulky, the UI trying to find stuff, but it worked for us, and it was essentially carrying a lot of maps with us. So we put in all the countries we would have. So that's obviously. Better done on a phone today.
Sure.
And I think with voice, with turn-by-turn, with Siri-type functionality, it's a no-brainer that already apps have overtaken much, much more expensive alternatives for navigation in the car for they've been added for a decade. So you use
navigation and anything else?
Yeah, navigation. The other thing is I wanted to test my speed, and that was I'm using a GPS app for speed. Let me just look it up now for a second.
Your travel efficiency, or you're just
you're
trying to track your routes, or what are we doing?
Well, it's called GPS Speed HD. That's GPS Speed HD. That app, I think it was a German company that put it together. It's very nice because it has multiple ways of seeing your. The speedometer, it has altimeter, it can track your journey and give you a graph showing where what speed you were doing at what time. It will upload that data for you so you can overlay it on Google Maps. It has maps also as well if you want to turn that on. It has a G meter, so you can
send. I was going to ask my friends who race, send me these things, you know, these videos of them racing with the G's and the speeds and all that
but
stuff.
Yeah, but it was exactly $2, this app, and it
right.
has a huge amount of coolness to it. It even has a heads-up display mode,
so
you can put it on your dashboard, and at night it'll reflect in a way that is, it has a compass. It has a little fuel gauge, which is actually measuring your battery. It has, digital readout if you want on the speed, or you can have an analog readout, and you can change the scale of the analog scale to be, you know, with, you know, maxing at 120, maxing at 60, and so on. So you have a better resolution than you would have on your speedometer. I mean, imagine if you could do that with your regular speedometer and change its resolution so that you'd know with more precision whether you are at 55 or 50, because you were nervous, you know, versus having a speedometer that goes from 0 to 200 miles an hour. That doesn't help you in the low figures. And it had, like I said, altitude tracking and all these other things. So $2 app, I found it a lot of fun because I could check the speedometer's accuracy, and I found that it actually understates by 5 kilometers an hour. And I've used it also on the boat. I've even used it once on a plane, even though it's illegal.
Right.
But I wanted to see how it works, and it actually does work if you have cellular coverage. But the other thing is, so that app
GPS
is great.
GPS HD, okay.
Yeah, GPS HD, and if you can see the potential, because not only does it track that, if what I wish it had was a connection to the car's fuel consumption, because then I would just use it on my average everyday routes.
Sure.
To track my and identified, you could identify where you're using too much gas, for example. So it could train you, and it helps you become a more efficient driver. Just like if you're carrying, and I don't know if you've tried this, but if you have this Nike Fuel Band, you get to learn. It teaches you roughly.
Sure. What gets to what, know you and your habits, of course, and your exercise
but it,
regimen.
You have this feedback mechanism, and you say, okay, I think today I didn't do enough exercise. And even if you take it off, you start to calibrate your activity level mentally, just like if you track your calorie consumption with an app, which I used for a while called Lose It. If in that you had to type in everything, so it's very inefficient, but you, after a while, you'd educate yourself about how much food you're eating and how much calories you're ingesting.
Right.
So that's the thing. I just feel smarter, even if these things are a very modest type of improvement to my. So in terms of in car, now there are things on the horizon, like we talk about iOS in the car, but also these I forget the name, I think it's called a company called Automatic that provides a little dongle that you actually
right,
stick
it
to
plugs
car.
Into the car's network, right?
I'm really looking forward to that. I don't know if it works in every car in the world, but it's targeted towards the U.S. because of the OBRD. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So every car built after a certain year, you plug this in, and it automatically broadcasts to your phone all your engine performance and acceleration and fuel and everything else. So suddenly, you're going to be informed about all that stuff. So for a person who's keen on data, keen on statistics, this is great. This is, means I can have a spreadsheet and I can analyze things. But I think ultimately it's going to be boiled down to a much simpler system, just like the Nike Fuel Band doesn't give you the data in calories, but gives you the data in these fuel points, right? In Nike points, and these points are normalized so that you can compare yourself to another individual. And so it ought to give you a simple score for average people to tell them, hey, you're a good driver, or you have a heavy foot, or you're economic driver, or you're not. So if it boils it down to a game type thing where you essentially can brag about it, then we're getting somewhere. I mean, think of the fuel savings. Never mind the fact that, you know, you can have all this regulation that requires manufacturers to make cars more efficient. But if everybody changed their driving habits, even by 1%, it would have a huge impact to fuel consumption. Basic things like turning off the engine if you're stuck in traffic. Basic things like don't accelerate when you don't need to. And don't brake too suddenly if you don't need to.
Or use cruise control, right?
Yeah, or use cruise control, or just feather the throttle. And if you, this is something that no one can teach anybody, because you just tell them how to drive, but they're instinctively going to do something different. But if they get the feedback from a machine, and they, over time it gives them incentive to compare to someone else their performance, then you're starting to really affect driving behavior. That is really big. And if it's something delivered on the $2 app, I mean, come on, it's a no-brainer.
So does this open up a iTunes-style opportunity then for new entrants or competitors to swipe the activity attention of car buyers?
Yeah, so now we get to the whole manufacturer, what their incentives are, because I think the problem is that we don't know the answer. We especially don't know how consumers will behave when given this information. And the thing that's wonderful about the software industry is that it has a very rapid learning cycle, and there are millions in, or let's say at least thousands of developers eager to go
into the market. Sure.
Yeah, there's low costs of entry, rapid cycle times. All the learning happens quickly, and you get instant feedback from the users because all these devices are connected. So it's not that the manufacturer should let go of the control for the, you know, because they're stupid or they don't know, but because that entire ecosystem that's based on phones is so much better at solving the problem and will get much, much better. Now, the thing is that the tempting thing to do, the temptation is that you partner with a Google or a Microsoft, as they've done before.
Sure, which
or
is
with, even with an Apple.
Right.
And you say, okay, we're a big company. We're going to trust another big company to sort of, a short circuit or
you take
or
care of this for us, we'll ride along, you pay us a fee.
Yeah, we have contracts, lawyers, and so on.
Right.
And you get into this idea that, okay, we're going to have the salvation in another large company, but they're not as good as the little guys in solving the problem because they don't have the cycle time. And the learning is what it's all about. This problem needs to be solved through learning, that we don't know the answer. The internet business models that emerged through a process of iteration, not because somebody knew exactly the right way to, you know, Google succeeded on its sixth business plan, I'm told. So, and Apple is still figuring out what their business is going to be, right? 34 years later. So, my expectation is that there has to the innovation, the solution, the jobs to be done will be discovered by the ecosystems that will be built on top of APIs for the car. And unfortunately for the manufacturers is that they will lose control over the users' experience, firstly. Secondly, loyalty.
Right.
Because you might be more loyal to an app than to a car.
Sure, that experience.
And platforms and all these other information-based value layers on top of the car. It's nothing they can do about it. I mean, you can't hold on and expect that you will. The
old ways will continue. Right?
Yeah. So there'll be resistance all along the way, but I think ultimately they're going to have to accept the new order.
But for buyers and sellers, is this yet another cashectomy? You know, where it's another opportunity to pull fees out of our wallets, or is this, as you say, a learning, a better experience, or how do you see it?
The costs are so much lower. Usually an entrant like this will have the additional functionality. Value will be much higher than the cost paid. We're seeing it in entertainment. You used to have to pay huge sums for the CD changers. Right, remember they used to cost hundreds of dollars, and CD player itself was an expensive option in a car. And now music is just an audio auxiliary input, or maybe it's a direct connection.
Thinly valued, that's right.
Or Bluetooth, right? That's even better. And so the idea is that from the consumer's point of view, they're already spending the money on the platform side, on a device, on the network. Access through a device that are consuming hundreds, if not thousands, a year. So for them, they're just marrying that world with the car world, which they're also spending thousands on. And then the difference is that actually the option, the margin value on top of the car for these options that used to be thousands of dollars, like in-car navigation.
$2,200, yes.
Those are gone. They're just not going to be there. And if someone says, "What?" the logic would be this, hey, get Twitter in your car for only $400, you know. or somebody comes along with Facebook, and then, you know, you wait 5 years, and BMW says, yes, now we support Facebook, right. You know. It's only a $700 option.
Right.
It's like... you know, they'll charge you extra for an analog clock in a car, for God's sake. I mean, think about that. It's how many little things they
But I was thinking about a different angle than the direct angle, and that was, you know, I'm familiar in the U.S. at least, there are insurance companies now who will sell you insurance based on your driving patterns. So if you think about more and more of this data being available, you know, Ford announced, quote, an open platform for their cars. Again, I don't know how open it is. I haven't looked at the details. But if people can tap into that, these app makers or the ecosystems, and then they share it, as we're seeing in a lot of other industries, you know, does that change the economics for the buyers and sellers of cars? The cost of using it, you know, the Uber models and some of these car sharing things, will those grow as there's more data about what we do with our cars and change the
economics?
Sure.
I mean, this is hard to see that far ahead, though I think someone will definitely figure out a service model that sits on top of this new platform that says, look, that information that you're generating through your driving can be a data mine, can be a mine for value, and then it'll figure out ways to solve different jobs to be done with service concept, because it just is a recurring thing, right? You have to subscribe to it. But I can't think of all of these options, because they're going to come about through iteration. They're going to come about through trial and error. I think it's going to happen, and I think that as we're seeing also in the smartphone space, the services that sit on top of the phone are not provided by typically the system's builder. So although we may use Apple or Android or Windows, the value that accrues from social media goes to Facebook and Twitter, and very few. Google tried, but it's still unsuccessful with social media, and so the problem is that you may get a little bit of rent fees from the system. So think of it again. I think that the best analogy would be this: take the computing model and think of the car model as roughly analogous, meaning that there's several platforms on top of each other. There's obviously in the case of the computer, you have the CPU is a platform. So you had the Intel architecture, you have the ARM architecture. And on the car, you're going to possibly modularize into a powertrain architecture, chassis architecture,
sure. Safety and convenience,
and then,
all that.
Right. So famously, many people have argued that the car industry would modularize years ago, and it hasn't yet. It's still preserved as an integrated solution, although there is more supplier power than there used to be, but there hasn't yet broken down so that there's the car, all the engines are made by, you know, a group of companies, and all the chassis are made by another group of companies, and it's all contract manufactured by a third group of companies, and then it's marketed by a fourth group of companies. That hasn't happened. But the argument always is that, look, something is going to cause this to break up, and the powertrain could be such a thing. A new manufacturing process could be such a thing. You know, we talked about this idea of the ice stream from Gordon Murray, right. How that might cause a modularization to happen. All of these are hypotheticals, and it's possible, and they may be catalyzed. But the point is that the architecture, right, whether those layers are modular or not, on top of that, there will be also what we call the information layers and the networking layers and the service layers. And the car today has some layers on top of it, but they're typically like the dealer network, the government network, which is basically
sure the roads, the taxes, the licensing,
taking care of the roads, the network. So think of it as a unit inside of a network, and a node. You know, not a node, but so much, but it's a participant in this network, and that network needs to be maintained so that the owner of the car is the ultimate source of funding for the network. But there are these other externalities or external network to the car itself, and those are not going to go away. But or maybe the dealer might be affected somewhat. But the thing is that we're going to add yet another layer, which is the information layer, which doesn't exist today. The information layer, it's itself several layers deep. There are these systems providers, which are maybe Apple in the case of iOS in the car. Maybe there'll be a Google layer, alternative, I'm sure, from Microsoft. Sure, they've been trying for a decade.
Right.
Whether Facebook or not, we don't know. But I think there'll be, on top of the system layer, there'll be the apps layer, and then there'll be the service layer. So some core apps like Maps will be maybe provided by the systems company, and that's the case in smartphones today. So the car itself will be like a smartphone that will have its layers on top. So that's the vision of how to think about it, and the value chain evolution theory is that as the new value is created somewhere, disruptive value is created somewhere within the value chain, profits may actually start to accrue to that point and make that layer much more powerful than the other layers, and therefore they'll start to dictate the evolution of the whole value chain.
Right.
This is what happened with Microsoft and Intel, where the loci, the centers of gravity, which attracted, you know, in the gravity field, attracted profits, and because of that, they came the Wintel duopolies that they absorbed all the value in the whole value chain, and so everybody else was impoverished, and they could dictate which way the platform or the entire system would go. So, in that sense, if the car were to modularize a bit, and then we would have the information guys suddenly dictating. Or because they capture more value, their influence grows, they might start to design cars. They might tell people that, look, in order for the next generation of Facebook to be successful, or let's say Google, to be this great new service we have that discovers destinations, that lets people shop more, that lets people buy stuff,
sure,
right, create economic
trips.
Value.
Sure.
It might influence the decision of car manufacturers to change the car, in effect, to the compliance of a Google network. So the Google guys might say, well, we need your car to have the following sensors because we're going to guide people, you know, more rapidly, you know, whether it's driverless or not, but we're going to guide people to spend all their money in the mall, let's say. So make sure
preferred
that,
route,
you know,
yes.
make sure that if the driver tries to steer away from the mall, that you take control away from them.
That's,
you know,
right. I'm thinking of the information layer in the airline business. I mean, think about flying many years ago when we just had mainframes and limited memory and limited processing power. And now if you want to fly from Helsinki to London or Berlin or Paris, you have maybe 26 different fares and 50 routes and various levels of pain. And perhaps that's how it'll play out in the
And what's causing it, yeah, the disruption there is that the clouds and the fare aggregators,
right, the third parties, right,
these guys are starting to influence, of, you know, the decisions of airlines about,
right,
routing, about everything. It hasn't quite caused them to change their businesses, but
no,
but because a lot of them actually are somewhat
monopolistic, they control certain routes. And
yeah, and they also have a say in sort of the Amadeus system versus,
right,
the Sabre system, and those systems have been split off of the airlines. But
you have a good example, because many years ago, American Airlines, when they owned Sabre, found themselves in antitrust trouble because they'd always bring their flights up first. And so, as you say, you know, you're going past the mall. Well, gee, now you're being penalized for not stopping there and not buying your fuel
so
someplace.
So it gets ugly fast.
Right.
But the thing is that that the hub and spoke system that airlines found to be more profitable caused a change in the designer of aircraft, and so you had the market split much more in a polarized way for aircraft, so that you had sort of the short haul,
right, the 737 routes and long routes, yeah,
exactly. So you can see already that the economics of airlines affected airframe.
Sure,
builders.
Because you can manage it at a much more, micro level.
Yeah, this is, and this is again this value chain evolution that Boeing doesn't anymore decide what the future of aircraft is. It's airlines that decide what the future of the
aircraft. And the finance industry, yes.
Yes, and finance industry, exactly. And whether at some point in the future, cloud will decide what jetliners are going to look like. That remains to be seen. But that's the essential influence factor that you know as you analyze the value chains and you realize that the profit may be accruing somewhere else. It also, by the way, the other thing has to happen is that competition is going to make sure that the other layers are commoditized, and
right.
That may not always happen because not all markets are perfectly competitive, and that's why you may have national policy coming to effect, national brand preferences, and so on.
So we've talked about road trips today. We've talked about Tesla's positioning in the market and maybe disrupting the high end somewhat. I had some data last week that their model is outselling the Germans in California, at least certain segments of the German market in California. And then we talked about the potential for new players and new entrants to grab consumers via apps and via new layers in the auto game. So a full discussion today, Horace.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's always fun. Always
right.
Fun. And it's been a while because we've been traveling, but it was good to get back on
yes.
the road in a
yes.
way. Yeah.